May it please the court, my name is Reed Page and I'm here on behalf of Merity Baker and Sue Carol Kunda, the appellants. It's important to note at the outset that this case was decided on a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-5. And in order for the district court to have granted that, the district court had to have determined that assuming all of the alleged facts in the complaint were true, that there were still no claims whatsoever under Colorado law. There are two reasons why this court should reverse the district court's decision. The first of which is under the fraudulent concealment theory. There is a duty for this, for the defendants to have provided complete information and to have disclosed more information. When they made the decision to draft the November 2003 letter that provided half of the truth related to the administration of the estate. The second issue is on the professional negligence claims in this case. This court should step in and make it clear that in Colorado, intended third-party beneficiaries are allowed to step into the shoes of the testator and force their intent when an attorney's professional negligence frustrates that intent. There are two questions that the court has to answer on each of these claims. That is, whether the claim is available under Colorado law and whether the facts alleged in the complaint fit within that law. On the fraudulent concealment claim, first off, this is a direct claim between Merity Baker and Sue Carol Kunda and the defendants. It's based on the November 2003 letter that was sent directly from the law firm to them. And if you look at the Berger versus Security Pacific Information Systems case, as well as Restatement Second of Torts, Section 551.2b, and Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 4.1, Comment 1, which doesn't provide the duty but clarifies some of this in the context of attorney communications. Those sources of law state that when you provide information, when you make the decision to speak, you don't necessarily have to speak, but when you make the decision to do so, you can't provide half of the truth. You have to provide a complete story that doesn't allow the information that is disclosed to be misleading.
That's fraudulent concealment versus fraudulent omission, the half-truth concept.
Yeah, well, Your Honor, it falls under the fraudulent concealment. In the Berger v. Security Pacific case, they're dealing with the fraudulent concealment claim, and that is where the half-truth law in Colorado sort of comes out, where in that setting.
So within the complaint, looking at another civil rule of procedure, 9, which specific allegations in the complaint support the fraudulent concealment claim?
Yes, Your Honor. There are, in that, as the district court ruled, it ruled that there are 3 faults with the complaint. That we did not plead that there were facts that were concealed, that we did not plead that the defendants knew they were being concealed, and that they intended the plaintiffs to act on. If you look at the actual complaint, the allegations of what was concealed, there are 4 critical facts. The first of which is the letter discusses some of the assets of the estate moving into the trusts as put together in the estate plan. However, it fails to disclose that the overwhelming majority of the estate is moving outside of that. It's held in joint tenancy between Floyd Baker and Betty Baker. So some of the dollars are going into the trusts. Many of the dollars are not going into the trust at all under the estate.
Now, this is the Brendan letter that you're speaking of?
Yes, the November 3rd letter.
At the time that the November 3rd letter was written, is there information that Brendan knew these half-truths existed of which you speak?
Well, the attorney, the Woodris and Haynes law firm, had put together the estate plan. They had put together the wills for both of the parties, and they were the ones who had this information. And that's pled in the complaint that they knew that they were concealed. And remember, this is, you assume that all the facts alleged are accurate. In paragraphs 81, 84, 89, and 90 of the complaint, that these are attorneys who have prepared these documents. They knew how the estate was being administered, and they were the attorneys to the personal representative of the estate, in fact, Betty Baker, and they were in the process of all of this happening.
So, Mr. Page, was the whole letter alleged in the complaint or attached to the complaint?
The whole letter was not attached to the complaint, Your Honor. It was attached to the motion to dismiss.
So what I'm wondering about is the fact that letter said, it provided certain information, and then it said, you might want to get your own lawyer. Well, now, how does that fit into your claims for fraudulent concealment.
Well, I think that the when you're dealing with this circumstance, there are three other facts that it doesn't disclose, one of which is they state in the letter, we represent Betty Baker as personal representative of the estate only. They don't disclose that they also represent her as an individual. And in that circumstance, Betty Baker's role is to administer the estate as intended in the documents, as in, intended in the estate plan. Not.
I'm sorry, but it goes back to a point that I'm trying to focus
yes,
on.
Sir.
At the time the letter was written, and it says we represent her in her personal capacity, is there any evidence that they also represented her at that time that the letter was written in her individual capacity?
Well, the evidence, well, there isn't evidence of it, Your Honor, because we're at the pleading stage. However, the allegations in the complaint are that this is the law firm that put together the estate plan of both Floyd and Betty Baker. They're the ones that drafted the estate plan and the wills, and they're the ones that had been involved in this from the outset. And they weren't, they didn't represent her in her personal capacity. They represented her in her capacity as personal representative of the estate. So they knew how the estate was being administered at that time.
So, Mr. Page, if I could come back to the questions I was asking you. I don't understand how a claim can be based on fraudulent concealment with regard to the November 2003 letter, when part, as I understand it, part of that letter says you may want to see a lawyer, and then if you didn't refer to that part of the letter anywhere in your complaint, doesn't that create a problem in terms of alleging that there was fraudulent concealment when the whole letter hasn't been set forth in your complaint or referred to in your complaint?
Well, I'm not sure that I necessarily understand why the letter would need to be attached to the complaint at that time when you're discussing it and you're making it clear what the facts that were concealed or that were not disclosed are there.
Well, it just seems to me that if your allegation is based upon partial or half disclosure, as you describe it, and yet the letter also says you might want to see a lawyer with regard to this, that seems like it would be germane to the validity of a claim for fraudulent concealment.
Certainly, this is an argument that would certainly be made at a trial about what that means and whether they were giving adequate statements of you go find your people or you go find an attorney to look at this. But the complaint accurately states the items that were concealed, and there were four of them, about the administration of the estate and how the money was moving into Betty Baker's hands directly and how when that made it into her hands, it would be able to be dealt with in any way possible that she wanted to. And they failed to disclose these facts. While they said some of the money's going into the trusts and such, they failed to disclose that this other majority of the estate was not making it into the trusts that were in the estate plan at all. And then finally, this final disclosure of we represent her in her personal capacity only, and at the same time they're drafting the documents that move drafting the documents for her individually that move the majority of the estate out of the trusts and into her hands and into her daughter's hands rather than being split equally amongst the surviving children. Moving on to the professional negligence claim that's in this case. When you look at the Schreiner's and Glover cases, they have they analyze the facts of those cases in specifically under the test that we suggest the court should implement in these circumstances. And that's a three-element test. Were you an intended third-party beneficiary? Was the testator's intent frustrated by the professional negligence of the testator's attorney? And were your benefits decreased as a result of that professional negligence? Schreiner's and Glover both clearly state that under the operative facts of those cases, they refuse to, or they're declining to extend the law that far. However, the facts of those cases are not necessarily analogous to this, whereas the McLean case that we cite in our briefs is. And in that case, you have a woman who owned a farm with her sister in joint tenancy, trying to pass that estate down to the tenant farmers that had lived on that property for three decades or so and worked it. And the attorney failed to, and this was admitted, the attorney failed to advise her that pulling it out of joint tenancy was necessary in order for her to affect that intent, and the law firm failed to pull it out of joint tenancy. And in those circumstances, the Illinois court ruled that they were intended third-party beneficiaries under Illinois law, which is different than Colorado law. They ruled that that failure and that professional negligence frustrated the testator's intent because there was clear evidence at the trial that that intent was there and that she wanted this to pass to them, and that their benefit was wiped out completely by this. And so they allowed the claim, which is a very similar situation to this. These are assets that were left in joint tenancy, and thus they didn't make it into the estate plan and the trusts that were created there.
Counsel, where does the will or the trust document express the testator's intent vis-a-vis the disposition of joint tenancy proceeds?
Yes, Your Honor. It is in Article 3. If you read Article 3, it doesn't state it explicitly. It doesn't state the sentence, pull these out of joint tenancy. However, there are two facts that relate to that. First off, that paragraph would make no sense. It is not needed to be included in the will if they wanted to leave these assets in joint tenancy. Because the first sentence of it is, these will pass to my wife in the event that I predecease her. And there is no need for that direction if they wanted him to stay in joint tenancy. They would naturally pass that way. And then then the paragraph would in fact say the second two sentences related to the bequeath to Paula, as well as wiping it out if they both died at the same time.
The joint tenancy and the operation of how it operates as a matter of law, that it automatically passes to the living joint tenant, doesn't that effectively effectuate what the testator provided in Article 3, which is, you know, if the wife does not survive, then Paula is to get condominium.
Your Honor, there's a reason why the article is in the will, we would argue, and that reason is because they wanted to take the items out of joint tenancy and make it so they made it into the estate plan and get moved in that way. So if they move them out of the joint tenancy ownership structure, then that paragraph is necessary. If they leave it in joint, and then especially as it relates to the will that was submitted with the motion to dismiss, there's a handwritten note on it. We think that this is why this was converted into a Rule 56 motion in general, because they're accepting things that are unclear and facts that are sort of disputed. There's a note that says JT with spouse. And we would argue that that means these are in joint tenancy now, and take them out, and we need to fix that. I'm sure that defense counsel will argue that it means leave them in joint tenancy, but this is the point. But we think that those two
counsel
items,
you have a minute 45
yes,
left,
Your Honor. Okay. We believe that both of those indicate that they wanted these out of joint tenancy, and that they that's what the intent was, and that this was frustrated, and that Colorado should allow such claims.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Carolyn Fairless, attorney registration number 30215. Along with me at council table is my colleague Kendra Beckwith, and we represent the appellees, the law firm of Woodruff and Hames, Mr. Cook, and Ms. Brendan. May it please the court. The plaintiffs here are beneficiaries who are unsatisfied with the amounts that they received under their parents' wills. They did not bring a will contest. They did not seek to sue the personal representative of the estate. They did not seek to sue the estate, nor could they. The law is clear that a testator can leave his or her estate to whomever he or she chooses. And in this case, the estates were properly administered. The wills did what they were written to do. Instead, the plaintiffs have sought to recover the difference between the inheritance they wanted to receive and the inheritance that they did receive. 7 years after the fact, from the lawyers who did the estate planning for Floyd Baker. In doing so, they asked this court to create a rule of law that has not before been recognized in Colorado, that would contravene existing Colorado law, and that would allow the plaintiffs to come in years after the fact as disgruntled beneficiaries, many of whom have disparate interests, to sue a lawyer who was never theirs. In doing so, they have miscited the law, they have mischaracterized the record, and this court, for various reasons, should affirm the trial court. First, the court can affirm the trial court on any basis, and the plaintiffs in this case have never argued that their claims are in fact timely. In fact, their claims, based solely on the allegations of the complaint, as well as the two documents referenced in the complaint, are time barred. They raise
only two. Did the trial court ever rule on that point of which you speak?
The trial court did not rule on that issue, did not need to reach that issue in its order. But this court can affirm on any basis raised below, and this was raised in the motion to dismiss.
Ms. Fairless, what is your response to your opponent's contention that there are factual issues with regard to the statute of limitations?
There are no factual issues based solely on what they have pledged, Your Honor. To begin, they themselves plead in paragraph 34 of their second amended complaint that they had actual knowledge on March 12, 2009, that Mr. Floyd Baker's intent allegedly had been frustrated. At that time, 2 years after that, their claims undeniably would have accrued. 2 years after March 12, 2009, they had filed claims against only two of the defendants below, not against Ms. Brundon.
Right, so your argument is that their claim is untimely with regard to Ms. Brundon, but weren't the claims against the other defendants timely?
They were not, for a different reason. First, as I mentioned, based solely on their alleged actual knowledge, the claims against Ms. Brundon are timely, but that is not the standard for accrual of the statute of limitations. The standard is, when should the plaintiff have known? And so it's not an actual standard, it's a new or should have known standard. They allege in the complaint that they received the letter from Ms. Brundon on November 2003. And importantly, that letter didn't just say, I am not your lawyer. That letter also said, the second sentence, enclosed, each of you will find a copy of the last will and testament of Floyd R. Baker. They were given at that time complete information regarding how their father's estate would be handled in administration. At that point in time, if they believed that the property should be severed out of joint tenancy in contravention of what the will actually says, they could have gone down to the real property records, which are public record, and they could have confirmed whether or not that in fact happened. Instead,
what about
they
waited
7 years.
Counsel, what about their allegation that there's a genuine issue of material fact regarding the timing of the disposition of property? Why doesn't that create a tribal issue?
Your Honor, with respect to their argument about the tribal issue of fact regarding disposition of the fact of the property, they're referring to this handwritten notation on the will, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly. And that does not create a tribal issue for a couple of reasons. First of all, the trial court never considered the handwritten notation, and the reason why the trial court never considered it is because nobody ever argued it on the Rule 12 motion. In response to Rule 12 motion, they never argued that the will that had been submitted with the motion was anything other than an accurate copy of the will. That was something that was only broached by them later.
Ms. Fairless, speaking of things never considered, do you have any idea why Judge Hagelin did not address the statute of limitations issue in light of the fact that you raised it before him?
Your Honor, I can only speculate as to what is going on in Judge Hagelin's mind, but Judge Hagelin did not need to reach the issue because Judge Hagelin decided, based upon the fact that there was no duty, based upon the fact that Colorado law sets forth the general rule that an attorney has no liability whatsoever to a non-client unless certain very specific exceptions existed, none of which exist in this case. Therefore, the judge stopped at that point and did not need to render what was essentially an additional opinion regarding statute of limitations. But again, this court can and should consider that issue now on appeal. And that is something that in their opening brief and their reply brief, the plaintiffs have never argued that their claims in fact were timely. They only argue that we did not raise it in a cross appeal, and therefore it should have not been considered by this court. And they also argue that on a motion to dismiss, the statute of limitations can never be considered by this court. But that is in contravention of Colorado law, and specifically the Sternbach case was a case where the court considered statute of limitations on a motion for judgment on the pleadings and found that, in fact, the claims were untimely. So this court need not even reach the issue of duty.
Ms. Fairless, let me redirect you a little bit to the negligent misrepresentation claim. Although it wasn't raised by the other side in their opening argument, I have some questions about it myself. Would you agree that under the case decided by the Supreme Court,
Mahaffey,
that they do have standing to bring a negligent misrepresentation claim is part one, and if so, then we would need to address the merits of that claim. Would you start with the standing issue?
I would agree that a plaintiff theoretically can have standing to assert a claim for negligent misrepresentation against an attorney. And that is one of the exceptions to the general rule of non-liability to non-clients. But Mahaffey makes clear, as does the 2011 case of Allen versus Steele, that in order for a negligent misrepresentation claim to be asserted against an attorney, the elements of Section 552 of the restatement have to be met. And one of those elements, and this is the element that the court in Allen versus Steele held was not met by the plaintiff in that case, is that the misrepresentation that is alleged has to have been made to the plaintiff for the plaintiff's benefit in connection with a business transaction.
Now, in the Allen case, they said something a little broader than that, though further down. They said a business transaction is defined as an action that affects the actor's financial or economic interests, including the making of a contract. Why doesn't that apply here?
It does not apply because, as the court also said in Allen versus Steele, it has to be a commercial transaction. The court looked at Black's Law Dictionary, the court looked at the rules of professional conduct, and looked at the rules of professional conduct that prohibit lawyers from entering into business transactions with clients. And obviously, a fee agreement, for example, is a business transaction with a client. But in that case, the court said that if there's only an incidental financial benefit, that does not apply. And in Allen versus Steele, the specific facts of that case were that the client went to the lawyer for assistance with an underlying civil lawsuit. There is money involved in a civil lawsuit. And the Supreme Court said that does not qualify as the type of commercial business transaction that needs to be in place for this exception to apply. Here, the plaintiffs did not have any commercial or business transaction. They were simply recipients of monies under a will. There's nothing commercial about it. So for that reason, the very threshold element that Allen versus Steele talked about in the context of misrepresentation claims against attorneys has not been met and cannot be met in this case. Second, even if this were a different case involving different facts involving a business transaction, what the court in Allen versus Steele and Mahaffey also said is under Section 552 of the restatement, which sets forth the elements, we need to look at those. And those elements include that there has to be some sort of information that is provided by the lawyer. And that's a very important element because lawyers have duties of confidentiality to their clients under Rule 1.6 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. So to say on the one hand that a lawyer has to keep their clients' information confidential, but on the other hand, that they have an affirmative obligation to provide information to non-clients is inconsistent. So what the case law says is that if a lawyer affirmatively provides information, that information has to be accurate. But the lawyer has no duty to tattle on his or her clients. And that's what the plaintiffs here are alleging the defendants should have done. The letter that Ms. Brunden sent in November 2003 attached a copy of the will. It informed them of the fact that she was not their attorney and that they needed to get their own legal advice. And this letter, as the first sentence states, was sent in response to an inquiry that was made by the plaintiffs. It is difficult to think of a case where when a non-client contacts an attorney and asks for information regarding their parents' estate plan, where the attorney could have done a better job of responding to them. This was not a negligent misrepresentation. This was not a fraud on the part of the client. If this type of a letter can give rise to civil liability to the non-client, what response possibly could not give rise to civil liability?
Counsel, the letter specifically indicates that the law firm or this attorney is representing Betty Baker as personal representative of Mr. Baker's estate only. Now, that information changed where they undertook to represent her individually, not just as a personal representative. So having led the beneficiaries to believe that their representation was limited, why didn't they then have a duty to advise when that representation expanded?
There are three reasons why this is not an incorrect statement and did not give rise to any additional obligation on the part of the lawyers. First, when she said, "I represent Betty Baker as a personal representative only," what she was referring to is what the rest of that sentence says, because the sentence goes on to say, "and I cannot represent either of you individually." She's saying, "I can only represent Ms. Baker. I cannot represent you." So they are misreading the letter. Second, even if they were not, the letter only states that I am not representing her now. It doesn't state I am never going to represent her. And so there's nothing inaccurate about the statement. In fact, in their complaint, and this is paragraph 28 of their second amended complaint, they allege that Betty did not execute her will until a year after this letter was written. And then she executed two subsequent codicils to her will over the intervening years. So the will that was in place when Ms. Baker died was not executed until several years after this letter was sent. There's no obligation to predict the future and to predict what will happen. And a negligent misrepresentation claim cannot be based on the fact that even though you presently intend to do something, that intention changes down the road. More fundamentally, Ms. Brunden had no obligation to tell them about the fact that she was doing legal work for any client. That is client confidential information under Rule 1.6. It had nothing to do with what was going on with their father's estate. Ms. Baker could have disinherited the plaintiffs completely. That was her prerogative to do. And there is no obligation on the part of the lawyers to tell that to the plaintiffs here. It was something they and everybody is well aware of. They have not pointed to any case in Colorado that has ever, and there is no case in Colorado, that has ever allowed a dissatisfied beneficiary to sue an attorney. And there are a number of public policy reasons why that would be a terrible result. If an attorney knows that a client wants to disinherit one of their children, will the attorney try to convince the client otherwise? Not because it's in the client's best interest, but to prevent potential liability against the lawyer. These are the reasons why the rule is the rule in Colorado, that absent an exception, which does not exist here, there's no liability to non-clients. Because of that, because of the fact that their claims are untimely, we respectfully request that this court affirm the ruling of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, to start with your question related to the negligent misrepresentation claim, Judge Roman, the language that you quote in the Allen v. Steele case is exactly the reason why this is a business transaction. It is a action that affects the financial or economic interests of both Merity Baker and Sue Carol Kunda. And when you look at Colorado law, the Colorado statutes relating to defining the administration of estates, CRS 15-10, 2015-20135, as well as CRS 11-101-40135. It makes clear that the administration of estates, and these people are supervising this estate essentially as intended third-party beneficiaries, and it significantly affects their financial or economic interest. And so this would fall within Allen v. Steele and allow a negligent misrepresentation claim to proceed under that law. In addition, on the statute of limitations questions that you asked about, the reason that the judge did not rule on those is because they're not proper at a motion to dismiss stage in under clear Colorado law. McPherson holds that, and Dodge v. Shoemaker explains why. It's a heavily fact-intensive issue that requires the development of a record. And so, for instance, in this case, even if you were to get to it, the question is when did they know or should they have reasonably known about each of the elements of the claims that were brought? And just because they received the will on one date doesn't mean that that's when they actually knew who was involved in the drafting of it, who was involved in the potential liability in that estate plan and the failures of that estate plan. And that doesn't necessarily, that takes time to develop.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.